Hey, everyone. It's Lizzie O'Leary in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway for Monday, April 6th.
The idea that the sort of lockdowns that people are envisioning in New York City are even feasible where I come from just doesn't fly.
In many words on the show today, the South, and how its present and future look a lot different in the age of COVID-19, not to mention its recent past.
These were the perfect conditions for spread, and unfortunately, now we're paying the price.
Then, how racial bias may play a role as hospitals decide who lives and who dies.
We can't expect to have equity in hospitals if we don't have equality and equity everywhere else.
Plus, a little lighter fare with Ziwei Fumido from the Desus and Mero crew on our series, Joking from a Distance.
How do I interact with this, like, very traumatic human moment and bring levity to it?
All right, busy show today. Let's get started. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of the podcast What Next TBD at Slate, and I'm in for Tanzina Vega all this month. This is The Takeaway. It's good to have you with us. Our crew is mostly working from home again this week, with a couple of people in the studio helping us all get to your ears. I am in my apartment, so if you hear sirens or birds or my dog, it is all real. And speaking of sirens, they've pretty much become the soundtrack of my neighborhood in Brooklyn. And all of New York, really, since COVID-19 made its way here and overwhelmed our hospitals. Since the outbreak began, there have been around 340,000 reported cases in the U.S. And of those cases, around 10,000 people have reportedly died as a result of the novel coronavirus. But experts agree the real numbers are likely much higher. The numbers we're hearing don't capture the full scope of the pandemic and the number of people it's affecting. So today, we're heading to the U.S. South. Though it started on the coasts, COVID-19 is engulfing the rest of the country and disproportionately striking communities of color. And the South is certainly no exception. As we reported on our show last week, COVID-19 is devastating parts of rural Georgia. Now, Louisiana is a growing hotspot, with New Orleans expected to become the next epicenter of the pandemic. According to new research, the virus is killing residents in the southeastern part of the state at higher rates than elsewhere in the country. And without the resources of major metro areas like New York City, communities in the South are at even greater risk. Especially given the inequities in the region when we're talking about public health, access to food, and infrastructure. So today on The Takeaway, we're breaking it all down for you. I'm joined by three people who know a lot about how this pandemic is unfolding in the South. Van R. Newkirk II is a staff writer with The Atlantic. Dr. Rebecca Gee is the former secretary of the Louisiana Department of Health and now head of the Louisiana State University's Healthcare Services Division. And Dr. Marinel Payton is the chair and professor of epidemiology at Jackson State University's School of Public Health in Mississippi. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Van, I want to start with you because you've written quite a bit about this. How is what we're seeing in the South with the COVID-19 epidemic different than what we're seeing everywhere else in the country?
Well, I think what we're seeing, especially in the states that are reporting high numbers of deaths, so Louisiana and Georgia right now, is that a higher proportion of those deaths are in people who are not considered in the highest risk group elsewhere. So usually in other places in Colorado, in Washington, in China and Italy, it's mostly people over 70. But actually in Georgia and Louisiana, there's a much higher proportion of people under 70, folks with likely who have comorbidities. That's likely because of the health profile of the South.
Tell me about that health profile a little bit.
Well, you've got a higher proportion of the population that has underlying conditions that we know are going to lead to more likely severe complications from COVID-19. So you've got more people with hypertension, with diabetes, with heart disease, a whole raft of problems often together. But we do know there are more people at risk of worse complications in the South.
Dr. Gee, I want to bring you in here. When we talk about these health complications and existing health disparities in the region, what accounts for those?
Certainly, historical poverty. You know, Louisiana is one of three states in the nation where 40% or more of our people live below 200% of poverty. You know, issues of historical segregation, racism, and social vulnerability are higher in the Deep South. And certainly, Those same issues come to play here. I would say certainly in Louisiana, the majority of folks are over 70, and there are smaller numbers below. But certainly if you look at the Chinese data, you know, individuals with cardiovascular disease and diabetes are at high risk. And if you look at CDC maps, whether it's the Social Vulnerability Index or its indexes of chronic disease, the Deep South and particularly Louisiana often are the heat maps of those, and all of these things interrelate.
Dr. Payton, what are you seeing in Mississippi? Does it jibe with what Dr. Gee and Van are talking about?
Yes, it does. Actually, listening to Dr. Gee completely mirrors what's going on here in the state of Mississippi. You know, the state is leading the country in health disparities, number two in diabetes, number one in heart disease. As she mentioned, cardiovascular disease puts those with COVID-19 at greater risk. And also, you have to consider things like obesity, because most of the obese here have underlying problems as well, even the younger population. So it's definitely putting a strain on the overall healthcare system. You know, already every day we have thousands of people with heart disease. We have heart attacks or stroke. Now that the hospitals have become inundated with COVID-19, my question, my concern as a healthcare provider is, what are we going to do with our healthcare system? How are we going to treat those of us that just might have the, I'm just going to say, the usual problems?
Van, you wrote a lot in your piece, and you mentioned it just now, about younger people with severe COVID cases. Is there any other demographic information that we have so far, and we're relatively early into this, that we can tease out about who is getting sick and who is getting really sick?
We are still in the early stages of getting data from state health departments, understanding exactly what's going on. So you don't want to overinterpret. I think all we can say for sure is that right now, so far, in the states that are recording age, which not all states do, of the cases and deaths, they're just, especially among the population of people who are working age, more working age folks who appear to be dying. And that's really, I don't know how much you can tease it, the data further than that, but that's what it appears like.
Do we know anything yet about race and socioeconomic status?
There's a couple people who are pushing for those data right now. I think there was a bill introduced by Anna Pressley to direct HHS to do this. I know Michigan has released some preliminary data on that, and those preliminary data basically show or would indicate things that are consistent with this conversation: more African-American people proportionally with serious complications.
Dr. Payton, one thing that's striking is a figure that Mississippi Today reported saying your state has the highest rate of hospitalizations, roughly 31%, among people who have tested positive for COVID-19. Do you have any sense why people in Mississippi who are getting infected are being hospitalized at such high rates?
I'm assuming, you know, based on this conversation and what we've just said, that it's probably closely associated with the comorbidities, you know, given the fact that there are persons that are experiencing problems already. We know that Mississippi is sick. This is one of the sickest states in the nation. And then when you compound it with such a virus such as COVID-19, you can actually understand why there would be such high hospitalization rates.
Dr. Gee, New Orleans, we know, has become a hotspot in this pandemic. Why did the disease spread so quickly there? And I know that this is a touchy subject in Louisiana, but what role did Mardi Gras play?
We just don't know that yet. But what we do know is this was one of the largest convenings of people from all over the world in the United States at the time when we now know the virus was spreading, and before individuals at the CDC or other officials had confirmed that. And we did not have the ability to broad scale test at that time. And so there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking, blaming individuals who should not be blamed at that time, because we had not implemented, I would say, the appropriate public health surveillance and the level of attention was not on it. We did not have population health estimates of COVID. We only knew about individuals who had travel related COVID. And so, you know, nothing at that point was being canceled. So Mardi Gras went on, but certainly these were the perfect conditions for spread. And unfortunately, now we're paying the price.
Van, let's talk a little bit about state governments here, because so much has fallen on the shoulders of state governments, and we've seen different responses in different states. What are some of the things we are seeing, say, in Louisiana or in other states in terms of dealing with this or issuing stay-at-home orders?
Well, we've seen, like you said, a pretty wide variance. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards has moved, I'd say, pretty aggressively on this front, especially in predicting how this thing was actually, it will look in weeks, and trying to encourage people to stay home. People in Louisiana, at least, have seen the curve and know what it looks like in April, mid-April, and people are afraid. Some other states haven't moved quite as quickly. Likely that's because there isn't as much surveillance. They don't have the type of explosion that New Orleans has had. And some people, I think, have a bit higher sense of security than they should.
Dr. Gee, I think about Louisiana, and it's a place I've reported a lot. I remember talking to people post-Hurricane Katrina who used to work at Charity Hospital, which is now closed. And I wonder what the uptick in COVID cases has meant for the hospital systems in the state.
You know, I think it's important to make sure we're looking at the right kind of data. I know you can say, well, how many percent of people who have COVID are in a hospital? That's really a better measure of how many people you're testing than how many people are sick. I think what we're really interested in is the per capita death rate, i.e. how many people are dying per population. And those numbers are startling. We have the highest by far death rate in the U.S., higher than New York, and our people are sicker. And back to your point about Mississippi, I mean, Mississippi should have done this weeks ago. We've been doing this for weeks. There are no firm borders in this nation, and we should assume that COVID is everywhere. And so the fact that we have governors who have not been as aggressive as John Bel Edwards just means that this is going to be a longer journey to get this under control, and is unfortunate. You know, we all need to think about this, I think, from the standpoint of a national response, and assume that although in New Orleans we have these numbers now, and next week it's Mississippi, and the sooner that we stay at home, the quicker we're going to save lives and reduce transmission. But just to say that these heat maps of chronic disease are also related to levels of inaction. I mean, if you look at a map of who acted quickly, you know, Washington State, Oregon, places where people generally are healthier, and the Deep South acting more slowly, you know, Governor DeSantis, you know, really, particularly with Florida and that population being so so much older and at risk, it does not bode well for us with the combination of our chronic disease, and that puts us at higher rates of death. I know in our ICU, for example, in Washington State, a report came out in the New England Journal that about 75% of their patients who needed an ICU admission had to have a ventilator. In Louisiana, at Ochsner, it's 86%. So we are sicker when we're getting it, whether we're young or we're old, because of our chronic conditions. And I think, therefore, those areas that are higher risk because of our social vulnerability or chronic disease need to act aggressively, just as Governor Edwards has, so that we can save lives and make sure to flatten this curve.
Dr. Gee, you mentioned heat maps, and Southerners are more likely to be uninsured compared to people in other parts of the U.S. Is there a similar heat map that you could apply in terms of insurance rates? And what does that mean for access to care?
Well, so the good news is that in 2016, and I served under the governor as his health secretary then, and his first act was to expand Medicaid, which I led, we were able to reduce the uninsurance rate in our state from 1 in 4 adults being uninsured to now an 8% uninsurance rate, which is lower than the national average. So the fact that our people do have primary care, they have access to, in fact, we ranked 8th in the nation on utilization of primary care last year on the BRFSS survey. So that bodes well for us in terms of individuals having the ability to get access to a doctor outside of an ER or hospital setting. That being said, health insurance doesn't undo chronic disease. And so despite the fact that we're seeing really exciting increases on cancer screening, mental health and substance use treatment, and all of those things that you can fix with health insurance, you know, with our obesity rates have remained stagnant, our heart disease rates haven't changed. Certainly our diabetes patients who need medication have more access to it, but we still have chronic disease despite the uninsurance. But I'm even more worried for places like Mississippi that don't have a Medicaid expansion.
Well, yeah, Dr. Payton, what does access to insurance and to care look like in Mississippi, particularly in the more rural parts of the state?
That's one of the greatest concerns, people who are in the rural area and, as Dr. Gee said, who do not have Medicaid expansion. It looks really dire. I think that's another problem that COVID-19 is actually bringing to states like Mississippi. People are having a very, very hard time even without COVID-19 in reference to health insurance. A lot of people actually just don't have it. The job employment rate is like 30 times higher than it was before COVID-19, and a lot of those people are without health insurance, so things are pretty gloom.
I want to talk a little bit about infrastructure and transit in the South. Van, is it more difficult, do you think, for people to limit their movements? I think about my in-laws. They live in a, you know, pretty small city in South Georgia, and people are being told, you know, stay home, limit your movements. But how do you do that if, say, you live in a food desert or someplace where you got to drive for a while to get essential services?
Are we talking about the graphic that everybody was talking about?
Oh, yeah. Big map in the New York Times. Yeah.
Yeah. I think lots of folks just really didn't quite have a handle on what life is like, even before the age of physical distancing and lockdowns in rural areas, especially all across the country, but definitely in the South. You know, it's not just food deserts. It's how many people in this country have to travel more than 15 minutes to get a prescription? And lots of those people are in the South. So the idea that the sort of lockdowns that people are envisioning in New York City are even feasible, say in where I come from, which is Eastern North Carolina, just doesn't fly. If you don't pick up toilet paper from Walmart, which is a 30-minute drive in some places away, you can't just Postmate it. It doesn't work that way. So really what we should be measuring is whether people are changing their patterns over the existing patterns. And we know that Southerners, that people in rural areas tend to drive more, they tend to drive longer distances every day. And so I think we are seeing in places outside of cities across the country that people are limiting their distance traveled compared to what they usually do. And that's a good sign that these 87-90% of Americans under lockdown orders right now are actually following them.
Dr. Payton, are you seeing that in Mississippi?
I am, yes. A lot of people are happy that the stay-at-home order was actually put in place because people are afraid, you know? And even though there are longer distances to drive to get things like groceries, at least people are doing that. And it's sad to say, but I know people are sort of, I hate to use the term, stocking up on things, at least for the next month, so that they will not have to, you know, get out.
Van, we are also talking about a population that has a higher incarceration rate than anywhere else in the country. What do we know about what this means for people in prisons and jails?
The population in prison is probably the most vulnerable to just about any, outside of nursing homes maybe, the most vulnerable to about any pandemic that could sweep this country. They live in tight quarters. The type of distancing we're recommending on a public health level is almost impossible to achieve. Baseline, you already see higher rates of comorbidities, of higher rates of infectious disease in prisons. So right now, it's just a mess. I think we already see there is one federal prison in Louisiana that's experiencing a pretty decent-sized outbreak. You see it in New York and in Rikers. Two things I think are emblematic of what we will expect to see in prisons across the country and obviously across the South, which, as you said, incarcerates more people per capita than anywhere else.
Dr. Gee, go ahead.
One thing I just wanted to highlight, and this is, I think, a real issue of health equity, and I talked to President Veray, who's president of Xavier University, yesterday about this. We're both concerned that people who are frontline workers, those who are in prisons, those who are minimum wage workers, who are disproportionate to our region. But this is the same issue throughout the country. We're focused so much on healthcare workers having protective gear, but not for these workers. And so we've got a lot of people on the front lines working in these conditions who, you know, may not have appropriate protection. I think this is an issue that NIOSH needs to focus on, and we need workplace safety recommendations that need to be promulgated throughout the United States so that those individuals who are cashiers at grocery stores are on the front lines too, and they're very important, and we need to protect them as well. So I think we need to think about health equity and in this regard as well.
Dr. Rebecca Gee is the head of the Louisiana State University's Healthcare Services Division. Van R. Newkirk II is a staff writer with The Atlantic. And Dr. Marinel Payton is a professor of epidemiology at Jackson State University's School of Public Health. As hospitals across the country face an increasing number of coronavirus patients, early data shows people of color are testing positive and dying at much higher rates. In Milwaukee, one of the few places that has released a racial breakdown of COVID-19 cases, African Americans made up 81% of deaths in a county that is only 27% Black. And in Black communities across Michigan, Illinois, and North Carolina, there are also a high number of reported cases. But severe shortages of medical equipment and staff across the country mean that healthcare providers are now forced to make decisions about whose life to save in critical situations. And that means racial bias could play a role in how doctors allocate life-saving treatment. I spoke with Kiara Bridges about this. She's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. And she writes about race, class, and disparities in healthcare. And I also spoke with Douglas White, the vice chair and professor of critical care medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. He also directs the program on ethics and decision-making in critical illness. First, I asked Doug how these critical decisions are typically made in hospitals.
In ordinary circumstances, decisions about, for example, whether to use a ventilator or admit a patient to intensive care really come down to an individualized conversation between a doctor and the patient, if the patient is awake and able, or the patient's family, focused on both the patient's medical prognosis and the patient's values and preferences. So if the patient has a condition that is potentially treatable and the patient wishes to receive life-prolonging treatment, then the doctor and the patient or family collaboratively make a decision. In contrast, if there is a public health emergency where there is a true and severe shortage of ventilators, for example, the situation is really different in the sense that decisions will be made in ways that are not as focused on the individual well-being of patients so much as focused on maximizing the outcomes of the population of patients being served in that region.
So let's sort of dial back a little bit. And Kiara, I want to bring you in here, because before a patient gets into a hospital setting or an intensive care unit, there are a lot of different healthcare professionals along the way making decisions. Can you talk about what we know about bias against people of color along that journey?
People of color in this country are sicker and die earlier. And so scholars like myself working in this space have tried to figure out why that is. And a lot of the conversation has centered around bias, and specifically implicit bias. And the idea here is that providers, doctors, nurses, care providers along the entire chain have unconscious associations and aversions. And so by unconscious, it means that they're not exactly aware of them. So if you ask a provider, you know, do you think Black people are criminals? They'll say no. If you ask anybody if you think Black people are criminals, most people would say no, and they'll be honest. You know, they're not lying to you. The idea with implicit bias is that there is an association, for example, between Blackness and criminality, between Blackness and laziness, between Blackness and mendacity, you know, untruthfulness. And so these unconscious associations are manifested and usually under extreme time constraints. So when you're in a highly pressurized situation like an emergency room where there's a shortage of everything from masks to personal protective equipment to ventilators, this is an incredibly constrained environment. You know, it's just stressful. And so it's in those environments that people are going to act on their implicit biases, even though if you ask them, they would not say anything about being averse to people of color or preferring white people over people of color. And so the idea is that well before you've arrived at that place, that time when you're trying to figure out whether to admit somebody to ICU to give them a ventilator, people of color have encountered biases along the way in terms of, or have they been treated for the hypertension that they might have had? Have they been treated for diabetes? Have they been given the quality health care that would allow them to be healthier so that they're not in a situation where they need a ventilator at the end of life?
One of the reasons we're talking about this right now is obviously the coronavirus pandemic. And Doug, you developed a new set of guidelines for hospitals to help them make ethical decisions right now. Can you tell us a little bit about how that works?
This work dates back over a decade to the time that the avian influenza epidemic was going on, and then around the time of the H1N1 pandemic. And the existing guidelines from professional societies at the time we viewed to be highly ethically concerning because they recommended simply excluding from access to ICU care patients with certain characteristics, for example, those with advanced age, those with severe heart and lung problems, and those with cognitive impairments. And we viewed those to be, frankly, just discriminatory features of the guidelines. And so we set out to develop a very different approach. And the gist of that approach is that rather than excluding patients from ICU care, all patients who are normally eligible for ICU care remain eligible. And priority is given according to the likelihood that an individual will benefit, as defined by their likelihood of surviving to hospital discharge and beyond, according to objective measures. And so rather than saying these classes of people are excluded, everyone is included, and we go as far down the list as we can based on the availability of scarce resources.
Do you think having that kind of, I guess, checklist or framework helps doctors and care providers go back to the guidelines in an emergency situation?
I do. You know, I think the concerns that Kiara raised around implicit biases coming out in time-pressured circumstances are well taken. And so having clear guidance that clinicians can look to in very stressful circumstances, we think will decrease the bias in decisions and make decisions across classes of patients more consistent.
Kiara, Doug is talking about a lot of things that often are referred to as comorbidities, sort of other medical things that are going on. How important are issues of comorbidity when we're talking about patients of color?
So a person who has a history of malignancy, for example, so if you are a cancer survivor or if you have diabetes, if you have asthma, if you have a kidney disease and you've been receiving dialysis, right? All of those conditions place you at higher risk for developing more severe cases with the coronavirus. And so when I said earlier that Black people are sicker and die earlier than white people, it means that Black people more frequently have those comorbidities. So Black people more frequently have asthma. I mean, one of the causes of asthma is, you know, environmental. So living in a polluted environment. So people of color have been forced to live in really unhealthy environments. And the consequence of that is that we have higher incidences of asthma. People of color more frequently suffer from diabetes. We less frequently survive it. We less frequently survive cancers. And so all of the things that place people, individuals, at a higher risk of developing very severe cases of COVID-19 are all of the things that people of color have more frequently than white people. And so I think that the framework that Doug has developed is great, right? I think that standardization is incredibly important. It takes away the provider's discretion to decide, you know, I have a white patient who's 65 and, you know, privately insured, and he's the CEO and his family loves him very much, and I have to decide whether to give the ventilator to him, or a black patient who's 50, but he is, quote unquote, just a janitor, or he might have Medicaid. Or so the standard that the framework that Doug has developed will sort of remove the bias from that, the discretion, the ability for a physician to discriminate really in favor of the class privileged, race privileged person over the class unprivileged, the race unprivileged person. But I think that at that moment, a lot of bias, a lot of discrimination, a lot of racism has occurred already. It precedes that moment, and that in the effects of that racism is in the comorbidities that people of color tend to have more frequently than their white counterparts.
People will listen to this and say, well, these presumed biases against people of color are really about class. Mm-hmm. But you have written that that is not the case. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure, absolutely. So 3 to 4 times as many black women as white women die on the path of motherhood. And a lot of people, the intuition is to explain that disparity in terms of class. And the intuition has been that, well, you know, we all know that people of color disproportionately bear the burdens of poverty. And so the idea here is that people of color disproportionately die during pregnancy, childbirth, and shortly thereafter because they're disproportionately poor. However, that is not true. Those racial disparities in maternal mortality persist across income levels. So even when you're at the higher end of the socioeconomic ladder, when you are class privileged, when you might be a professor of law at UC Berkeley School of Law, I am more likely to die than my white counterpart at UC Berkeley School of Law. So we can't explain racial disparities in health simply in terms of class, and class does do some work towards making it more likely that people of color are sicker and will die earlier, but it does not do all of the heavy lifting. And so the moral of that story is that race matters, right? Race persists even in the post-civil rights era where we don't have sort of formal disenfranchisement of people of color. The structures that we have erected, the institutions that we have, the systems that we have in place have continued to function to limit the quality of the lives that people of color have, even when they have some degree of class privilege.
Doug, when we talk about training healthcare workers, how do hospitals incorporate thinking about implicit bias when they are doing that? And does that still get kind of equally factored into an institution's thinking when you are in an all hands on deck kind of situation?
Great questions. First, on the issue of training, I've been heartened to see in the last decade much more focus of this, both in the undergraduate medical training, as well as in the training of residents and fellows in the hospital who go through a variety of trainings around implicit bias and other aspects of bias and discrimination. And then on your second point, I think the point that Kiara raised is right on the money, which is that these things are unconscious. And so it's not that someone is turning it on or off on purpose in a stressful time. It's that these things may be more likely to unearth themselves at these times when physicians are relying on what we call heuristics, which is, you know, fast and frugal mental shortcuts to make hard decisions in time-pressured circumstances. And frankly, that's why in the framework that we've developed, we have put in place a recommendation that it should not be bedside doctors who are making these decisions, and instead it should be a team called the triage team who are not engaged in bedside decision-making, don't have obligations to individual patients, and instead have a much broader and hopefully more objective view of the lay of the land in the hospital and how many beds there are and how many ventilators and how many sick patients. And, you know, the other part of how we are recommending that these triage teams function is that they should be blinded to certain attributes of the patients, like their race and their social status and their gender and sexuality and all these other things that we think are irrelevant to how triage decisions should be made. So that instead of these triage teams actually seeing and evaluating each patient, they'll be given a very limited amount of information on only the key points that we think are ethically relevant in making allocation decisions. And they'll base the prioritization on only those factors in a blinded way.
Kiara, I know you've thought about med schools and training as well. And I guess one of my questions right now is what your biggest concern is in terms of trying to carry some of that training into an emergency situation around COVID-19.
Yeah, you know, I really applaud the work that medical schools and hospitals and residency programs are doing around implicit bias and making sure that healthcare providers, the doctors, the residents, the students are aware of this phenomenon called implicit bias. And are, you know, in medical schools have even gone so far as to administer the implicit association test to their students. And so this is a test that purports to reveal the extent of biases. And so the idea here is that if a person knows that they too possess an implicit biases, pro-white, anti-Black implicit biases, they'll be more cautious about acting on them when they go out and practice medicine. But as Beck said, you know, this is not, no one is accusing anyone of doing, of being biased intentionally, right? And so these are unconscious. People don't choose to turn them on and off. So we can have the best of intentions, but if you're in a time pressure situation, running out of ventilators, running out of beds, it's hard to say, well, I'm not going to act on my pro-white, anti-Black implicit bias today. I'm more curious as to why everyone has anti-Black, pro-white implicit. And I say everyone because even people of color have pro-white, anti-Black implicit biases. And the reality is that we've created a society in which we should expect people to have pro-white, anti-Black implicit biases. We've created a society in which people of color are hyper-incarcerated, right? So we shouldn't be surprised if someone associates Blackness with criminality because we've created a criminal legal system that hyper-incarcerates people of color. We should not be surprised if we associate Blackness with poverty and indigency and laziness, right? And we shouldn't be surprised that we associate laziness with poverty, which is, you know, absolutely empirically inaccurate, but it's because people of color are disproportionately bear the burdens of poverty in this country. And so the solution to implicit bias is not attempting to cleanse physicians and clinicians of their implicit biases. The solution isn't to make them aware of their implicit biases and to say, you know, make sure you don't act on them today. But the solution is to create a world in which we don't have implicit biases in the first place. And so in order to create that world, we're going to have to do some, you know, mass reorganization. We're going to have to rethink how we distribute the benefits and burdens of capitalism. We're going to have to rethink how we address our social problems. We can't expect to have equality and equity in hospitals or in the, you know, in the healthcare provision space if we don't have equality and equity everywhere else.
Kiara Bridges is a professor at the UC Berkeley School of Law, and Douglas White is the vice chair and professor of critical care medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. And hey, you can listen to all of our coverage on COVID-19 by visiting thetakeaway.org/corona.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
The virus. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Tanzina Vega. For our series, Joking from a Distance, we've been speaking with comedians about how their lives are changing as comedy clubs close and more of their work moves into digital spaces. Today, we've got
Ziwe Fumido, and I am a comedian and writer for Showtime's Desus and Mero.
I spoke with Ziwe from her new makeshift office.
I am in Brooklyn, New York, and I have not seen the sun in days. I'm just reclining in my bed where I take my meetings, where I do my lunches. It's fantastic. Or horrible, depending on how you look at it.
Like a lot of comedians, Ziwe has been experimenting with workshopping her material on apps like Zoom.
It's been such an interesting experience because you're talking to hundreds of people, maybe thousands of people, and it's literally just me in my bed with no pants on. And so calibrating my comedy for that has been an interesting but rewarding experience. I feel like I can connect to more audience, but I also feel kind of isolated in a different way.
And while that feeling of isolation can make for some awkward moments, Ziwei's been trying to adapt her delivery to make it work.
Really, it's about just kind of talking through the silence and really making sure the jokes are making me laugh. I give myself laugh breaks to laugh at my own joke, and that's been really successful for me. But otherwise, just not ever stopping for a breath. And that has been how I've been making jokes online.
When I talked to Ziwei, she told me that social distancing has also brought out a new side of her comedy. And a quick heads up for anyone listening with kids at home, there is a brief mention of sex later in this conversation.
I think I'm more manic just because I really haven't left my house in, I've left my house twice in 2 weeks. And so as a result of that, you're really starting to see the stir crazy version of myself where I find the little things very, very funny. And I'm just really trying to entertain myself. So yeah, my comedy's changed because it's for the quarantine audience out there, all those quarantine heads who, you know, haven't left their house or showered in several days.
Do you have trouble making laughs in a moment like this? Like, it's so serious and it's scary, especially if you live in New York. Where do you look for that funny moment or for the new material?
Totally. So it's actually a double-edged sword because I process trauma through comedy. And that's the reason why I do professional comedy. That's the reason why I'm a funny person, is because for all my life, that's how I interact with things that make me feel viscerally uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So in that sense, nothing's really changed. But then in another sense, I'm starting to feel in my own personal life, people who have been affected by COVID-19. And that's really terrifying because how do you move on when so many tragedies are happening all around us? You know, as the death rate grows, or the people who are affected and getting sick and have to go to the hospital grow. So, and people who are unemployed by COVID-19 because of whatever the reason, layoffs and furloughs. So I think for me, it's just about like, how do I interact with this like very traumatic, like human moment and bring levity to it? And that's where my comedy comes from personally.
Do you worry about the venues where you've performed in the past? I mean, I know you were a regular at Union Hall, you know, you've been all these places. Do you worry about those small clubs?
Yes.
After whatever the after is, after all of this?
Definitely, because they make their livelihood by having people come together in a community, and that is literally not allowed. So I'm so worried for Union Hall and Bell House. I donated to their GoFundMe to help support the staff, and I encourage anyone who has a comedy club or a venue, music venue that they love and enjoy, to donate to any sort of GoFundMe or a fundraising charity just to support these like really precious. I would not be a functioning comedian, working live performer had it not been for my shows at Union Hall and the Bell House. And so I think I just want to give back, and I encourage anyone who's ever enjoyed a show there to do the same.
You live in New York. I live in New York. There is this very kind of indefatigable New York spirit. And so much of that comes from the kind of thing you're talking about at some of these venues where people come together and celebrate being New Yorkers. And it makes me wonder about this moment right now where we literally can't do that.
Yeah.
And whether the online ways you're trying to, you know, spread your work, like, do they feel like an appropriate substitute, or is there still something missing?
There's definitely something missing. The connection that you feel with an audience is absolutely irreplaceable. So online is a fantastic substitute, and I love performing. So that was something, that's a venue that I'll keep pursuing. But ultimately, I need my live shows to feel human, and I need to connect with the people that I make laugh and that make me laugh. Some of my best jokes that I've ever told have been from like me workshopping in a room, talking about all the bad dates I've gone on, and talking, you know, making fun of the name Xander, for example. And it's just that can't come in a virtual space, or I haven't seen it yet, but who knows?
You've mentioned, and you're also a writer for Desus and Mero on Showtime.
Yes.
How has that shifted during this time? You guys had Dr. Fauci on.
What's
doing that show from home like right now?
Well, it's so surreal because I'm literally looking at like my Zoom monitor and Dr. Fauci's in my living room. What does that's so surreal, and it's the way that we're connected because of technology is absolutely wild. And like the team on Desus and Mero is absolutely brilliant. Desus and Mero are like two geniuses of comedy ever. So that is really a nice experience because we're watching like these great minds come together to problem solve a very real issue that faces the entertainment industry. But it's all so surreal to communicate in this virtual realm.
This is a weird time because we hear so much about doctors, nurses, healthcare workers on the front lines. And then at the same time, people who make art and entertainment are also trying to do their work. How important is getting that humor and that art out to an audience right now?
I think that humor brings like catharsis. And so I'm able to not like curl up in a ball and just sob all day by making jokes. And I think people who are fans of comedy feel the reciprocal where they have to listen to jokes in order to not feel so dejected. So while I'm not an essential worker as someone who works at a grocery store or someone who's a nurse or a doctor who are literally on the front lines of like fighting the COVID-19 virus, I like to believe that my comedy brings levity and joy to people's lives in a way that uplifts them at a really depressing and trying time in American history.
The last time you were on The Takeaway, you talked about how comedy can help build empathy. I wonder if you feel like you've seen it do that now.
I mean, definitely. The way that I'm connecting to so many different people across the world who are just also feeling especially isolated and especially full of despair at a time like this is beyond belief. And I don't think I would be able to connect with people talking about how, for example, if at the last time I was tweeting about how if I had known the last time I ever had sex with someone would be the last time I had sex with them, I would have sexed harder, right? Which is on its surface like nonsensical, but this is a viral tweet that connects with so many people because they can identify with like wanting to sex harder, whatever that means, right? And so with comedy, it's just about like bringing people together and making sure that we're able to laugh in tragedy because this is our lives. We have to live and we have to make sure that the point of life is to enjoy it and enjoy that life we have.
Ziwe Fumido is a comedian and writer for Showtime's Desus and Mero. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, Lizzie. This was fantastic.
All right, everyone. That is day one for me. Been great being with you. And remember, I want to hear from you. So you can call us on any topic at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can tweet the show. We're at The Takeaway on Twitter. And I'm at Lizzie O'Reilly if you want to follow me. It's going to be a busy and potentially tough month, so let's get through it all together. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is The Takeaway. Talk with you tomorrow.